morning. It's nice to be here. I would like to thank the organizer for the opportunity to be here and talk about different problems. The title of my seminar is Multiscale Modeling, but essentially I would like to bring to your attention three different, related topics, and essentially I would like to generate some discussions maybe later about things we are doing, some of it related to what many of you doing and so on. And first of all, of course, the notion of the multi-scale modeling is not a new one. There are many problems where you have very different spatial and temporal scales, and so to describe it, a lot of methods were proposed. There are recently we kind of made a scheme of multi-scale modeling, and our classification is right here. I would like to present it on several slides. And so there are simple brute forces techniques, and people who can do dynamics, they just say, if we would like to extend our technique to different time scale, we just run our program longer. Or on spatial scale or statics, they just would like to use, let's say, band structure technique and describe domain wall motion. Also, there are some recent calculation of such kind, and both of them are not really practical, definitely not practical. I can discuss it separately. And in case of domain walls, it's simply a violation of applicability conditions. There are, I would say, clever brute force methods when your system has let's imagine localized defect, and to describe this defect, you have to use different scale, very tiny mesh, for instance. Again, I'm talking about numerical techniques. So, but you still use one particular method to describe whole system, and there are such techniques like wavelets, different incredible amount of multi-grid techniques, different coarse grain techniques, both in molecular dynamics and in spin dynamics. And my conclusion after analysis of literature is that it's still not practical. So here comes a very trivial idea of multi-scale modeling and philosophy of different scale separations. And this, again, is very trivial. For instance, I have two very famous equations of motion. I will move. I will move it myself, okay. Essentially, here we have Landau-Lifshitz equation. Here, Dempster oscillator. We would like to describe something on one particular scale, but we don't know where this friction coefficient comes, and it comes from somewhere, from completely different scale. In this particular simulation, we just take a number, but it's our way to mask those additional degrees of freedom. We have no idea. This is very simple multi-scale modeling or scale separation, and it's just a small illustration. And now, why we are doing this? Because when your problem has several effective scales inside, it might generate completely different physics and different explanation of some interesting phenomena, interest from applied and fundamental point of view. So this is a key factor why we are doing this. And those different scales can be very different. For instance, even from point of view of electronic structure, people or many body techniques. Here I have either surface of chromium-3 molecule. This is charge density, either surface, and this is magnetization density. This is chromium-3, and I resolve it an atomic scale. So as you can see, idea about magnetic moment being localized is very well justified here. So you can use just one spin stick here, here, and here. Of course, there is interatomic domain wall here, but we can neglect it. It's not so important, and it's a very nice approximation inside atom. So we are using classical quantum spins. This is okay, but when we are talking about itinerant magnetism, like in hydrogen 3, for instance, it's the same picture, the same triangular molecule, also charge density plot, isosurface and magnetization density. In this particular case, you cannot define any region where localized moment exists, and to describe behavioral spins inside, you really have to resolve this intra-atomic scales. Okay, but this is just kind of maybe fantastic example. I would like to solve some realistic problems in magnetism. I will be talking about permanent magnets because, in my opinion, this area where if you would like to do something useful in and using correlated electron theory, this is a good area because there are essentially three group of magnets, three families of magnets, permanent magnets. It's cobalt platinum type of magnets, iron platinum, iron palladium, and so on. Then there is samarium cobalt 5 and neodymium iron boron. Only three very important group of magnets. And our results for cobalt platinum type of system I'm going to show today. And those two systems we cannot describe right now. We would like to, and we need some help. We need some help here, and those magnets are very important from applied point of view. Okay, how about different length scales and applicability of theory for those systems? First of all, effective there is a very important parameter, domain wall width, 5 nanometers in rare earths, about 10 there, and about 110 3D magnets like iron and nickel. If I take local density approximation, of course I can describe iron, I can describe those systems too. In rare earths, there is a problem with applicability, I mean correlated system and so on. In model system, I can describe 3D magnets. Cobalt platinum is really questionable, and in rare earth magnets, because of very small domain wall width, I cannot use Landau theory, so I have to use something ab initio, let me say. And there are computational problems here because you have huge domain wall. To describe it in three-dimensional case, there is this unhappy face. In cobalt platinum, I think you can do this, and I will demonstrate that you can do this by using some combination of ab initio calculation and model approach. And there is a very happy face here. Domain wall is really small, so your system is really small, but in combination with this, we have a problem. Okay, now, one scary picture from material science, just one, I'm not going to show many of them. So, essentially, I would like to describe this domain wall motion and hysteresis phenomena in cobalt platinum type of materials. This is a generic picture. There are twins. There is a very famous defect, anti-phase boundary. It's those wiggles are there. And distribution of domain wall like this. So I would like to describe this picture. And the physics of this can be very simple. If we have a defect and then domain wall, and domain wall can be attracted to this defect or it can be a repeller, but in both cases you need to apply some magnetic field for the domain wall to go through this defect. And in both cases this critical field is related to coercivity. Essentially we are talking about getting this number. Okay, this is it about applied science. And now I'm going to show our final result, our final simulations. Later I will tell how we did and what we did. This is 70 nanometers box.
Can you say a little bit what determines the coercivity? I mean, which parameter Which is it related to the width of the domain wall, or to the magnetic anisotropy, or some combination of both, or what?
Well, we would like to find out. Here it's simplest possible picture of pinning. If there is a pinning, then there is this. This distance is not zero, and if it's a, if this defect is a repeller, then you have to apply some additional magnetic field, spend additional energy, and this leads to this distance, and this is coercivity, essentially. This is a coercivity, but this is a kind of ancient physics of coercivity. I'm going to show one more effect which was not predicted before and exists in this material, and this effect was obtained as a result of our multi-scale modeling. Okay, so this is actually our theoretical image of this. Okay, those are twins. Okay, this is cobalt platinum. Okay, those are twins, and there are many atoms inside.
Is it cobalt and the platinum? Is it a random alloy or is it
no?
Alloy?
It's cobalt platinum,
Okay,
and so on. And there are many atoms here, and this defect is anti-phase boundary. Anti-phase boundary, it's a simple defect when you move one half of your crystal with respect to another by half a period, okay?
Magnetic lattice or actual crystal lattice?
Crystal lattice.
Actual crystal lattice.
Yes.
You change cobalt and platinum.
Yes. Okay, so this is this so-called anti-phase boundary. And okay, everything here was simulated. Everything. Theoretical twinning structure, APBs, were obtained as a result of theoretical calculations, okay? And this is a domain wall. It's split. This is very important. So the domain wall in this material is not a straight line. In all previous calculations, model or any other calculation, assumption was that this is a straight line. And this splitting leads to new effect of coercivity here. And as you can see in this particular case, the main wall is located at APB. And we found that APB defect is an attractor for the domain wall. The physical reason for this is if you calculate magnetic anisotropy in cobalt platinum related to this defect, you will find out that locally magnetic anisotropy is very small compared to the bulk. This is a physical reason why this defect is an attractor. Exchange coupling is absolutely relevant in these systems, and here and here and here it's about the same. So it does not create any sources of pinning. So we have one source of coercivity is a pinning at APB. Actually, the fact that the main wall is not located always at APB because it's just a snapshot. Okay. Okay, and second reason for coercivity is the splitting. The splitting comes as a result of competition between exchange coupling, which prefers to have ferromagnetic coupling here, and magnetostatic interaction. So we found two different reasons for coercivity here, but what is important for my talk today is a discussion of how it was solved. First of all, let's analyze what kind of scales we have here in our system. First of all, we have a defect size. It's about 1 nanometer. Then the main wall, it's 5-10 nanometer. It's cobalt platinum or 3D platinum. Then there are a bunch of microstructural scales, and we would like to solve this problem all together. So now, our way to solve this problem is to use, let's say, ab initio calculations to produce some microscopic parameters, to use these parameters in micromagnetic simulations, and a skeleton we obtained from microstructural simulations, also with some parameters. So this is so what we have here: synergy of different approaches and constant interaction between different techniques, but through parameters. On this stage, on a stage of producing parameters, we have to use only ab initio calculations right now. There is no way you can describe right now properties of defect without doing reliable ab initio calculations. I call ab initio any techniques where you don't adjust result to experiment or something. There is no way to learn from experiment that anti-phase boundary has lower anisotropy compared to the bulk. Just no way. So you have to use ab initio calculations. But later, when you go on the next level of simulation, micromagnetism or microstructure situation is a little bit better. And I would say practically there are no problems. If we use, for instance, finite elements techniques, you don't have to improve this at all. This is very exact. This can treat all scales on equal footing. It's absolutely perfect. So don't try to improve this area. Everything is great there. In microstructure, we use master equation simulation. Those simulations also require some parameters. But what is interesting, the final result is not so sensitive to the to the numbers. You can vary your parameters in pretty wide range, and the final result will be very similar. Completely different situation when we are talking about microscopic parameters for micromagnetic calculations. It's completely different. It's very sensitive.
Can you explain the anti-phase boundaries? I mean, what determines the location of those? Is it the initial conditions or what? Because you're dealing with an order alloy, right?
Okay. So you did have previously ordered cobalt platinum
right. Atom.
Okay. Now in this particular case, so you cut it somewhere, there are many opportunities to cut it. So there are many APBs. And then you replace cobalt by platinum and platinum by cobalt. And this is anti-phase boundary.
Right.
It can be localized, just one atomic layer. It can be some diffusion here. So it's a lot of ab initio work to get this anti-phase boundary. And there are many of them.
But you treat that as given? I mean, or you allow the thing to relax and to anneal? I don't know. I mean, you start with a sample which already has some anti-phase boundaries. Like, I don't know what is your starting point in your simulation. You put the cobalt and the platinum at random, and then you find that defect?
Yes. We have a flow of concentration, and at the end we have a bunch of APBs as a result of those simulations.
And you quench that?
Yes.
You're not allowed to move?
Yes. And afterward we add magnetic degrees of freedom and kind of using adiabatic approach. So we have the structural degrees of freedom frozen, and we add magnetic on top of this and simulate magnetism afterward.
I don't understand. You throw the cobalt and the platinum at random. Why are those defects straight lines in your simulations? I mean, there's no reason why you would not have a more jagged shape. There's a strong tendency to form straight lines.
I mean, this?
Yes.
Well, there are straight lines and there are those curved lines.
Yeah, but it seems that it's fairly straight, right? If you throw cobalt and platinum at random, you don't expect those things to be straight.
You don't say it again. You don't expect this straight line?
Yeah. Why? Right. Why doesn't it have a more meandering form? Right.
No. We have here what we have here in master equation. We have flow of concentration, but we have an atomistic approach, and we have flow of concentration from one side to another side.
Uh-huh.
So and this. has been produced as a result of those simulations.
I see. So it's not that you start with random initial conditions. No.
We have a flow of concentration at finite temperatures, and we have all those elastic forces at T not equal zero inside. Okay. So. Oops. Okay. As a short conclusion, so we have a reference to our paper. First of all, to describe any magnetization processes, you have to use some kind of synergistic approach and combine several techniques together. Then, from physical point of view, we found, first of all, we proved that anti-phase boundary can be a pinion center. Before it was just an idea because such defect exists. And we proved that it's strong enough. And it produced about 50% of total coercivity we obtained. And second was from the splitting. And we didn't assume any smallness parameter before we started those calculations. So we used multi-scale approach, and coercivity we obtained also has a multi-scale nature, and we found two effects coming from completely different scales, one from interatomic, another one from much larger scale, and it looks like we are consistent. So we used multi-scale approach, and our physics is multi-scale, and this is a reference where it has been described. Actually, it has been published in PhysRef recently. How reliable are our parameters?
But do you know molecular dynamics of the cobalt and platinum atoms?
This is not a molecular dynamics. This is flow of concentration. For 0, 1, 0, 1, so it's...
Okay, but the flow of concentration has some underlying stochastic dynamics.
Yes, absolutely. But we don't have moves in space of those atoms. So atoms essentially jumping from position to position. It's not a molecular dynamics type of approach.
Lattice
is pretty much fixed, so only chemical disorder.
And the transition rates? How do you...
Oh, it's a master equation approach.
Yeah, but there are transition rates in the master equation, right? So how do you?
Well, this is a model. This is a model. So, but again, final results are not so sensitive. I would like to concentrate on those most. Where most of the trouble is, how to define parameters in ab initio calculation and how transfer them to micromagnetic calculations. So essentially, there are three very important parameters: exchange calculation, spin wave stiffness, and magnetic anisotropy. Of course, there is a friction coefficient in Landau-Lifshitz equation, but this is a completely different story. Again, why exchange coupling? Of course, you would like to talk about susceptibility, but more, this is more fundamental quantity, but if you would like to, for other people to use your calculations, for applied science to use your calculations, then you have to produce this J. And I will not be talking about anisotropy and spin stiffness a lot today. I just would like to say that because all famous magnets are anisotropic, you have to calculate anisotropy of spin wave stiffness. This is important. Previously, it was completely ignored in all micromagnetic calculations. And it could be important, this anisotropy could be important in those magnets. And when you analyze the manual motion, you have to include it specifically. This parameter is very important in domain wall business. Okay, then. This anisotropy has nothing to do with magnetic anisotropy. This is just structural, okay? Then, well, about magnetic anisotropy, well, I can talk a lot, but in this particular case, it requires very high level of accuracy, and what is interesting, it's not really located at one particular atom. You have to include a lot of interaction from other sides. Again, my main concern is exchange coupling, proper definition of exchange coupling, and so exact definition of exchange coupling is like this. If you used any rigid spin approximation, and introduce sites I and J, you end up with this. And in local approximation, where B is proportional to magnetization, this is what you have. And for many years, people use this definition. J is proportional to susceptibility, just because of this. And there is this density functional implementation by using a multiple scattering technique. And essentially, there are two approximations. First is a local approximation, this one, which is right only for extremely strong and correlated electrons. Okay, this local approximation. And second is this rigid spin approximation, so it requires some full potential approach. And so we decided to reconsider a little bit and went back to basic, and through susceptibility. So if we define a magnetic coupling like this one, then we can use a lot from dynamic susceptibility calculation from linear response technique. And in static case, we have essentially two definitions. This is static version of the exact exchange, and this localized moment definition. And this what was used in any calculational techniques for 30 years, this definition. This definition is more fundamental, and I would like to suggest to use this. And now I would like to show why it's important and where it's important. So this dispersion level for the spin wave in completely itinerant case can be described. In localized case, there is this zero notation. We end up with this. And if I regroup those terms exactly, I obtain this particular ratio between our kind of general spin wave spectrum and previously used Heisenberg type or localized type. So there is this enhancement factor, roughly speaking. And if I analyze what the smallness parameter, then I will see that essentially smallness criteria is omega divided by mi. And
question.
Uh-huh.
Can you make clear what is m in this formula?
M?
Yeah.
Magnetic moment. It's a splitting. This is a splitting. Mi. So I
modify spin wave theory.
What?
Is this just the magnetic moment at saturation?
Yeah. Yes. At zero. Yes. Absolutely. So typical value of I is 0.9 eV. So our estimation nickel, iron, and gadolinium for this smallness parameter. In gadolinium, of course, this is perfectly fine. In iron, actually, it's maybe 0.3. It's a little bit better at the zone boundary. And in nickel, it's rather bad. So our estimation for iron platinum have shown that you can describe exchange coupling between iron with good accuracy, but exchange between iron and platinum, your error can be 100%. And okay, so we have a kind of small competition between old localized definition and itinerant. And localized, by the way, it includes all degrees of freedom properly. Then, because this approximation I can call easily like long wave approximations, then spin wave stiffness is exact in old approach, is absolutely exact, and you can make those calculations in localized description. But if you would like to describe an exchange coupling between two nearest atoms, you have to be more careful and to use more general definition. And now, of course, all this related to one-site approximation. And one-site approximation is very popular. DMFT, our cell-consistent GW, and a bunch of other techniques. So if you use this one-site approximation from magnetic degrees of freedom, it means that you kind of work in this atomic limit and you underestimate your spin wave dispersion. This is clear. And this underestimation of your dispersion leads to any of those approaches to the smaller TC. So as a result, in any on-site approximation, your TC must be underestimated. So this is qualitative conclusion about exchange.
So how can it be? We know that mean fields tend to overestimate TC.
Mean field, yes. But if you do this long wave approximation, then you simply, this is dispersion. Atomic limit is like this, no dispersion. This is one-side approximation. And spin waves are here. And if you do any kind of localized approximation, you definitely neglect this dispersion. And if you just estimate TC by using this omega, because this is smaller, then your TC is always smaller.
Jessica, but then you should not put DMFT in that category, because in fact what DMFT would do to estimate the TC, yeah, it would replace omega of Q by the zone boundary magnet, not by the Q equal to zero, but the Q equal to pi pi.
So what DMFT does for this?
You would just take as a crude guess that the omega q is constant, but it would take in some sense an average constant. And it could be.
Okay, it could be, but what I was essentially had in mind is localized approximation. The fact of...
DMFT is not a localized approximation. In fact, you can get the full omega of q.
Full omega of q?
It's not central to your talk, but only the irreducible quantities, like the vertex function, is taken to be local. The susceptibility is highly non-local.
Susceptibility is non-local. Also, in any approximation, in our GW approach, one-side approach, it's also non-local. So you still have non-local behavior. What I'm saying, it's underestimated, just because any on-site approximation. Interaction between atoms, nearest neighbors, is a small parameter.
You mean the stiffness?
No, stiffness is exact, because this is small q. What I'm saying, nearest neighbor exchange is bad. But stiffness, combination of exchange in R squared, is perfectly fine. Just nearest neighbor exchange is bad.
So can you sketch, if you were to plot omega q as a function of q, can you sketch what you believe local approximation could do as compared to the...
Well, atomic is this one.
Sure.
Atomic is this one. Right one, somewhere here, when you include all interatomic interaction. And if you assume that your interaction between atoms in magnetic sense is rather small, then you're definitely working somewhere in between.
But so the stiffness, maybe I'm not...
Sure. Oh, stiffness, dq squared is perfectly fine.
Yes. You have the same curvature at the origin?
Yes, here derivative, second derivative is exactly the same for all.
That's a statement about the spin wave spectrum. And how you handle this to deduce the TC is a different story, right?
Yes, I just used the qualitative results that larger omega at Q gets, so larger TC gets. It's just really qualitative. If you, Tyablikov approach or any other approach, then this result is there. Okay. Well, I don't know what Logan did. I think it's just Landau phase transition theory, connection between susceptibility and exchange coupling. Okay, our conclusions on this stage about parameters. First of all, exchange coupling should be really properly defined and recalculated, especially in itinerant systems. Then spin wave stiffness, its matrix nature should be taken into account, and this is a very sensitive issue. It should be done really carefully. Now. Again, about our description, ab initio description of interaction in real materials, and it's probably related to what this school is about. So, if we are talking about ab initio correlated electron theory, so we have, of course, LDA and GW since 65, and no ab initio theories were proposed since that, and appearance of LDA plus U or any kind of combination, actually also kind of scale separation approach was suggested in 91, and since that many methods appeared, and I would like to show you one transparency. Sasha, no hard feeling, just a joke, okay? Like 4 years ago, I've shown this. I mean, if you are not able to produce ab initio theory of correlated materials, then of course you're kind of sleepy, and there are many monsters you will see, a combination of ab initio and adjustable techniques and so on. Sasha, just a joke. No hard feelings. Okay, we can talk a lot about why LDA plus U is bad, why it's good. What for me right now, what is important is take a look at this table. Here I collected data for 3D metals for gamma theory and experiment and theoretical bandwidth. If you look carefully, you will see that disagreement between theory and experiment exists not only for magnetic system, but also for non-magnetic. So, scandium. What?
Theory means LDA.
Theory means yes, LDA. LDA, yeah, probably LDA, yes.
Excuse me, what definitions of gamma and W? The definitions.
Gamma and W.
What is this?
Gamma is just the density of states, and this. Of course, here there is electron phonon enhancement and so on and so on. So it should be corrected. But I just would like qualitatively to say that that comparison with experiment is bad both for magnetic and non-magnetic system. LDA plus U, as a statement, our first starting point said that non-magnetic LDA is fine, and I will use this non-magnetic result and to handle all magnetic relation by adding U. So in this particular case, so we decide to do something ab initio, maybe not so fancy like dynamic mean field approach. We still would like to learn it. So what we did, we used perturbation theory, GW approach. We use one-side approximation. Effective contour integration. We later find out that it was published previously, and we can do GV and a little bit beyond GV, GW. And I don't have much time, so this is our conclusion, and now I will show some results. So we really believe that GW cell consistent GW can be considered as a reasonable ab initio alternative to both LDA and LDA plus U for reasonable value of parameter U in LDA plus U approach. Okay, I will skip physics of GW approach. Yes, physics of W approach. No, you probably know all this stuff about one side approximation. Okay. No. Physics. It's something really. First of all, why one-side approximation? Why one-side approximation? This is a wave function. I have a real plot, but it's just a sketch. This is a real function in D materials. And if I calculate screening radius by using this simple formulas, this screening radius will be 0.5 atomic units at this particular point where maximum wave function is. So screening is really inside our sphere, so we really believe that on-site approximation is reasonable. We have some better estimation of this. And second, this is effective parameter as function of energy from GW calculations of Ferdi Aristeyevan many years ago, like 95. So as you can see, it goes from 2 to 0, and this is effective bandwidth of D materials. So it's really energy dependent, and later it goes back to its unscreened value. And so those two factors, we believe, are important and should be included in any ab initio calculation, or if you would like your techniques to be ab initio, then those effects should be included explicitly.
What are the main effects that you're talking about the frequency or the space dependence of this?
Well, This should be included once. And second, you have to treat intraatomic degrees of freedom properly. You have to resolve your correlation intra-atomically. That's what I'm saying. So our parameter is non-local inside the sphere, and also it's energy dependent, roughly speaking.
But this W is also a function of Q, right?
It's a Hubbard parameter.
No.
It's an effective interaction.
Effective interaction.
Yeah.
In front of side of the force.
Yes. Or, I mean, what in LDA plus U, it's U. Essentially.
Then what is epsilon horizontal axis? W is vertical, right?
Yeah.
And horizontal axis.
Energy.
Which energy?
It's here. It's for instance, band which it's an energy-dependent parameter. W is a function of energy. It's a band energy.
W is already energy, right?
No, W is
no.
Green clone interaction.
This is green clone interaction. It's.
W is V minus V chi V, where chi is the density coefficient.
No, you have formula. Just put some. But what's the correspondence to the formula?
Okay. Those two important factors. Then one side approximation is this one. So for the self energy, we don't have K dependence. In standard GW approach, you have it. And this is why we have so many numerical troubles. If you remove this and just have this guy with R and R prime inside one atomic sphere, then your method is like 100 times faster, and there is an opportunity first to make self-consistent calculations, second to include maybe more diagrams. Well, this is a questionable area, but this is our approximation for 3D metals. Of course, it's not good for semiconductors and for some other materials, but we just, idea was to study cell consistency, how important this is for 3D metals. And we use linearized approach with green function of such kind, where self energy is defined by this integral of product G and W is essentially interaction you ask it, and this is polarization operator. Oh, it depends on energy, yes. Yes. Yeah, everywhere there is this scale. Okay, now, and we because technique is rather fast, we can make a lot of calculations, and for one particular material, when you compare LDA and GW, it may be not so useful. But when you have a tendency, you can really understand what's going on. So what do we have here? We have a density of states as function of energy for 3D metals. Black is LDA, red is GW, and blue lines, it's an experiment, XPS and BIS essentially. And okay, scandium is bad in LDA, we know, and it's not maybe good in GW also, but the point is the result, even for non-magnetic system, the result of GW and LDA are different. So this is important result. So there are different correlations even for non-magnetic systems. Okay, now probably you're more interested in iron and nickel. This is iron. And this is nickel. And what we have, what we don't have. For iron, I might have a little bit better picture. Like this one. Okay, LDA up and down, and green function up and down. Magnetic moment is close to 2.2, so it's pretty much like an LDA. And what is also what is interesting, how magnetic moment is progressing as function of included diagrams. When you include only exchange diagram, your magnetic moment like 3-bore magneton. When you include GW diagrams, this magnetic moment goes to 2-bore magneton already. So we believe that it's a main effect when we are talking about equilibrium magnetic moment. Then we don't have any magnetic splitting in GW is about the same or even larger compared to LDA, and nothing we can do to change it. So it looks like it should be an effect of higher order DMFT, Gutzwiller, or maybe some other diagrams. We don't have any answer for this. Density of states at the Fermi level is close to LDA value. So we don't have any improvement compared to LDA for the iron. If we include corresponding diagrams, we can reproduce in nickel and practically in other 3D metals, satellites in this region. We can do this, but it's kind of rather trivial. So we just did it, and it's there.
How does it compare with the full GW?
Full GW, you mean not one side?
Yes.
We don't have. We haven't done this. No one did it. So
no,
Ferdi did not do this. Again, what is GW? If you make one iteration and your starting point is LDA, then it's LDA GW. If your starting point is Hartree Fock, then it will be Hartree Fock GW or whatever. And all those results are very different. So if you ask me about LDA GW one iteration, it's for nickel, it's close, yeah.
By starting point, you mean which Green's function is used in the GW?
Yeah, Ferdi Aristiavan used essentially wave function and eigenvectors from the LMTO calculations, from LDA calculations. I mean, you can use Hartree Fock or whatever, but this is not a GW and has nothing to do with GW and realistic applicability. You have to do system calculation inside the scheme. So then you can say what is GW. Otherwise, you stuck with, I mean, everything depends on your initial starting point. Yeah, absolutely. So there are no cell consistent calculation to compare with, but we compared some quantities with Ferdi, and it looks like we have good agreement for that, for instance, with non-cell consistent calculations. And as you know, there are full-scale GW calculation for semiconductors. It was also the same with the reflector where our paper was published. So essentially, I would like to do better calculation and to include a cluster right now in GW to study this effect. But right now I cannot offer any answers to your questions. Okay, it looks like these are 4D systems. 4D systems. In some system you can say GW is doing a little bit better, like in this particular material. In some system, if you compare it to this spectrum, of course, no matrix element and so on, just the density of states. But qualitatively, it may be okay. But main conclusion is that looking at all those results for 3D and 4D systems, you cannot say that LDA is better than so consistent GW approach. Or vice versa. So you can use both of them. This is our initial result. But of course, we don't want to compete with LDA in its own backyard. Whole idea is maybe our correlations a little bit stronger in GW, so we can go beyond LDA and describe some materials LDA cannot. And most famous and clear exchange effect is gadolinium, where LDA gives you peaks at minus 4 eV and somewhere here, total splitting like 4 and 4.5. And experiment is right here. Experiment is right here, and splitting is like 12 eV. This most famous and cleanest effect illustration of disagreement between LDA and experiment. And if you do LDA plus U, you can put your peaks on those positions with properly chosen U. And so here we have our results for gadolinium using cell-consistent GW. This is LDA with a huge density of states at the Fermi level. And this is cell-consistent GW. And so the main point is, so we performed some electronic structure calculation for, it's iron and nickel, M and density of states at the Fermi level. Okay, here there are our conclusions. And essentially on this stage, the main conclusion is it looks like cell-consistent GW approach, even in one-side approximation, can be considered as an ab initio alternative to both LDA and LDA plus U for reasonable value of parameter U. And of course, it has much wider range of applicability because it has some dynamics. And and we do have some results for spin dynamics for 3D systems, both in LDA and in GW approach. And it looks they are consistent. It looks like in iron and nickel, you don't have to use idea of strongly correlated materials to describe majority of properties. You can use LDA, or you can use dynamic susceptibility calculation in frame of LDA, and you can describe majority of experiment, dynamics, temperature dependence, a lot of properties. You cannot describe some like satellites and like this smaller spin polarization in nickel, but the importance of this this is not clear from the applied point of view. But again, as I said initially, for our magnets, there are two groups of magnets, samarium cobalt 5 and neodymium iron boron family, where we believe that strongly correlated material theory and reliable description of them is very important from applied point of view, and this research is very, very relevant. Okay, this is it.